From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Today we continue our special programs. We return to our regular program on October the 16th, which is next week. Today we're going to be talking actually about travel, quite a bit of travel. First, up on the program, one of the largest groups from around the world actually that do traveling are from China. And they're traveling everywhere. And one specific area of interest to them are cruises, especially around the Pacific and also the Caribbean. To talk about Asians and tourism and how the industry is, we're now going to be joined by Jeff White, a name, of course, that you'll probably know from WRMI, Radio Miami International. Jeff has been following the cruising industry for a number of years, and he now joins us on the line from Miami.
Well, the biggest cruise port, of course, is Miami, followed closely by Fort Lauderdale, which is only 45 minutes away. Those are the two biggest cruise ports. And from there, most of the cruises are going, of course, right to the Bahamas, which is very close. Those are shorter cruises of maybe 2, 3, 4 days. And then you have one-week cruises, perhaps, or sometimes less than a week. They go to some of the other Caribbean islands. Usually you'll do the Western Caribbean route, which will go to the Mexico, Cozumel, and so on, and the Cayman Islands and Jamaica. And then there's the Eastern Caribbean route, which will go down to some of the islands, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and so on. And then some of the longer cruises will go even further down towards the Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao, and even to South America. And then you have some longer cruises that will go into the Caribbean, to like Cartagena, Colombia, and to Panama, and then some of them go into the Panama Canal, or some of them even, you know, cross the Panama Canal to the Pacific Ocean.
Now, with these cruises, you said the two largest ports are Fort Lauderdale and Miami. Does that mean that the majority of the cruises, these are the ports? For example, if somebody from China was to take a cruise in the Caribbean, they would have to fly to Florida first?
Yes. There are a few that leave from other places. There are some that leave from other ports in Florida, Jacksonville or Tampa on the West Coast. There are a few that leave from San Juan, Puerto Rico. And there are some that leave from during certain seasons from Galveston, Texas, or from the northeastern U.S., from New York, for example. But for the most variety of cruises available, yeah, it's pretty much South Florida, Miami and Fort Lauderdale.
Now, with these cruises, you mentioned, you know, sometimes maybe you'll go to Bahamas, just a very short trip, or maybe you'll visit, like, sometimes 3, 4, or maybe even 5 different countries. How does the visa thing work out? Does that mean, for example, if somebody, anybody in the world goes on these, they have to get 5 different visas?
Sometimes there are visa issues, but in the Caribbean, there's really no problem. As long as you have a visa to get into the U.S. so that you can take the cruise, you're in pretty good shape, because most of these islands don't require visas, or they have special arrangements with the cruise lines for people who are just, you know, stopping in a port for several hours to take an excursion or something like that. Occasionally, certain nationalities may have problems, but visas are not a big problem in most of the Caribbean islands and Central America. Most of the cruises leaving from Florida.
See, the reason I asked that, because I was very surprised to find out. I mean, here in Taiwan, we have a port, which is Geelong, which is the largest port in Taiwan. And a few times a year, we have cruise ships maybe that were doing a trip of the Pacific coming up to East Asia, and they'll stop here in Taiwan for a day or sometimes 2 days. And I was surprised to find out that when people leave the ship to go inland, come to Taipei, they don't even have a passport control.
That's right. Most of them don't. It's you know, there are special arrangements for these cruise ships. I went to the Bahamas the other day to Nassau, and they did actually check our passports very briefly, but No stamping and asking questions and that sort of thing. Because you can imagine some of these cruise ships have 4,000 or 5,000 passengers, and you get all these people unloading in a particular port. They're only going to be there for maybe 5, 6 hours or 7 hours, and they do not want to hold these people up at the with immigration and that sort of thing. They have to, they want them to get out and spend money in the stores and take their excursions, go to the beaches or whatever.
So it's a lot. It's probably a better way to say travel around the Caribbean instead of taking small hopper flights where you have to fly through airports.
Oh yeah, yeah, and actually, cruising is a very good way of traveling through Europe these days as well, because essentially, you're on the ship, you only have to pack and unpack one time, and you go from port to port, traveling usually at nighttime. And then spending your time during the day at these places, and it's a one price includes all, most things anyway, all of your food and that sort of thing. The excursions cost extra, but you can do a lot of countries in a relatively small amount of time this way. Of course, you're only getting a glance at each one. You're only getting one day or less than one day in each port in most cases. But if you want to see a lot of places in a fairly short amount of time for a quite reasonable price, it's a good way of doing it.
And on the cruise ships themselves, because there's, very often so many different nationalities, does that mean, for example, service is also available in these different languages?
Well, you might be surprised, but most of the cruise ships over in this part of the world, the crew comes from your part of the world. They are from the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, all over. Actually, there are some from quite a few now from Eastern Europe as well. But most of them are Asian, I would say. And so, and they all speak English, of course. Now, the announcements that they make, it depends on the particular cruise line, and they will vary this depending on the clientele that happened to be on the ship at the time. Some of them will do all their announcements in English. Usually there'll be two or three languages. Costa is one company that does them like five languages. And there's always people who speak multiple languages among the crew. And they'll have special booths or offices where people can go to visit people who speak their language if they need particular help or orientation on the ship.
And what are some of the most popular cruises that people can take? We mentioned, I would suspect the ones in the Western Hemisphere and around the Caribbean are extremely popular and Europe as well. What about other regions?
Well, Alaska, of course, is very popular. Most of those cruises leave from Seattle, Washington, or from Vancouver, close to Seattle there in Canada, and they'll go up to various ports in Alaska and sometimes combine them with excursions further into Alaska to Mount McKinley and Fairbanks and places like that. So that's very popular. Hawaii has quite a few cruises. Covering four or five islands in a week. There are a lot of one-week cruises there. And there are a lot of cruises that leave Hawaii and go down to the South Pacific that are longer cruises. So, some of them go on for, 30 days.
30 days?
Some of them. There are around-the-world cruises, Keith.
Really?
Where you can... In fact, there's one, I forget what it's called now, that you can actually live on the ship. And you just travel constantly around the world. It takes, 2 or 3 months or whatever to go around the world, but they just do that continuously. There's a lot of, and of course, there are more and more ports, more and more areas that are being developed for cruising as people, because there are a lot of repeat cruises. People who take cruises tend to repeat again and again and again, and they always want to go to new places. So now they're developing places like, the western coast, the fjords of Norway have been popular for quite some time. Now they're developing cruises to Greenland, for example. And of course, there are a few that go to Antarctica, leaving from southern South America, or I think from New Zealand. And so, there's a lot of adventure to be found. And the Middle East is also an area that's opening up. A lot of cruises now leave from Dubai, traveling to around that part of the world and into India and so on. And Asia is a very developing area now. You mentioned the Chinese cruisers. I was at a conference here in Miami, Cruise Shipping Miami, which is the biggest industry event every year, a few weeks ago. And they were saying that there was a presentation by the Hong Kong Tourist Board. They did a survey, and they were finding that they said that about 2 out of every 10 cruisers in the world now is Chinese. But within the next 5 to 10 years, they expect that to be as much as 8 out of 10. So the Chinese are really they seem to like cruising, and they're cruising around Asia, of course. A lot of cruises leave from Hong Kong and then go to Taiwan, and then from Taiwan, sometimes they'll take the north route up to Japan and Korea, and sometimes they'll take the southern route down to the Philippines. But more and more cruises are being developed in Asia, and of course Australia and New Zealand and the Pacific as well. But a lot of these Chinese tourists, of course, cruisers are coming over here to the U.S. and taking tourist cruises in the Caribbean and South America and so on.
Now, you mentioned the Middle East. I mean, with the situation in the Middle East, is that a region, let's say, that perhaps is starting to see a decline in clientele because of maybe security issues? Or do they really keep to parts of the Middle East that are secure for the most part?
Well, it is a bit more volatile probably than most regions. But in general, I think it's probably growing. But there are problems from time to time. For example, the other day we had the problem of the bombing at the Bardo Museum in Tunis, and the people that were in that museum were people from two Italian cruise ships. And for now, I believe those port calls in Tunis have been suspended. It probably won't last all that long. Generally speaking, Tunisia is a safe country, and they'll probably want to return. There were port calls that were, a lot of them were canceled during during the past few years, the crises in Egypt, for example. Some routes have been changed because of the problem with the pirates there off the coast of Somalia, some of the ships that have to go through there. And so, with these volatilities in the Middle East, there could be changes in itineraries. But that's, of course, the good thing about cruise ships. If there's a political problem, or if there is a storm, for example, in the Caribbean, if we have a hurricane or something, these ships can navigate, very quickly to another port, make arrangements and have people stop in a different country than they planned to, maybe, but still giving them a good experience.
So it sounds like more of an adventure than just flying somewhere. Oh, yes, we planned to go to the Bahamas, but we ended up in Panama,
Well, this can happen, and, a lot of people plan to be in a particular country, and then they're disappointed if they can't be. Sometimes it happens that a lot of these large cruise ships can't go into a port directly because they're too large for the port, and so they have to anchor offshore, and then people take what they call tenders, the small boats going from the ship into the port. And if the weather is rough, they often can't stop. They can't anchor out there, and they can't operate those tender boats. So sometimes they'll have to give people an extra day at sea, or they'll take them to a different island.
Huh. So if somebody is, interested in finding more about this and to, maybe start planning ahead, what is the best route?
Well, you can go to, of course, the websites of the various large cruise companies. We could mention a few, and SEAL, Norwegian Caribbean, Carnival, and MSC is a big one, Italian, big one in Europe. There are many others, of course, but perhaps the best place to start would be the Cruise Line International Association, CLIA, it's called, and that's www.cruising.org. And there you can get a look at, an idea of the many different lines operating in different parts of the world and the cruises that they operate.
And that was my conversation with Jeff White about cruising and the Asian tourist industry. Now, of course, there's all kinds of travel you can do. Some people like to go on package holidays. Now, for myself, I find this rather boring way to see any place. The other way, of course, is you buy a ticket, go somewhere, and hope for an adventure. And that's exactly what Matt Gibson did when he came to Taiwan.
When I came to Taiwan, it was a very random decision. I had just finished university and was struggling to pay student loans. So I took a job tree planting in Canada, which is a fairly well-known industry where you can make pretty good money for very hard work. And while I was tree planting, I met a fellow whose girlfriend was teaching in Taiwan. And we worked together for 3 days, and he decided to quit and go to Taiwan to teach English because he thought he could earn more money there. So he gave me his email address after 3 days and told me if I wanted to come, just to send him an email. And so about 6 months later, I did. And I hopped on a plane to Taiwan. I hardly even knew where it was on a map. And stayed with him for a month while I got myself set up with a job. And I ended up staying there for 6 years.
You know, it's quite interesting because Taiwan is one of those places where, I mean, I've heard this myself when people have asked me, like, where do you live? Where is your residence? And I say Taiwan. And they go, oh, isn't the capital Bangkok? And I say, wait a second, no, that's Thailand. Taiwan or the Republic of China is a different place.
Absolutely, yeah. When there was the tsunami in Thailand, my Facebook was flooded with people concerned about me. And I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm about 2,000 miles away.
So let me ask you then, you like to obviously travel. So were you using Taiwan as a base then for other areas in Asia?
Taiwan was very much my home after living there for 6 years, but it was an excellent jumping off point to go to other places in Asia, because once you're in Asia, there are a lot of budget airlines that will fly you places very cheaply. So we would sometimes get tickets to the Philippines round trip for about $40 or $50 US. So we visited the Philippines several times. It was very inexpensive to go to Thailand and to go to Cambodia or Laos or any place like that. So it was really just a great place to start from.
And how did you settle in here in Taiwan? I mean, I've been in Hong Kong and other places, even spent quite a few bit of time in China. And personally, I always found the first time that I came here a very easy place to settle in. It wasn't much of a culture shock or anything for me.
Taiwan is a very easy place to live, especially as an English teacher, because, well, first, it's one of the most amazingly friendly countries that I've ever been in. And people, they're very, very welcoming to outsiders and go out of their way to try to make you feel welcome. And as an English teacher, you earn a salary that's almost on par with a doctor or a lawyer. So as a young person just out of university, if you show up, everyone treats you very well. You make way more money than you could have ever imagined being able to make. You can live a great lifestyle. So a lot of people do show up for 1 year and end up staying there for 10 or longer.
Now, let's talk about traveling for a moment. When did this interest in you in adventure travel start?
I started writing about travel. My ambition was always to be a writer, and I used my time teaching English in Taiwan to start to launch that. And I thought that since I was in Taiwan, it would be a good idea to focus on travel writing. And as a natural extension of that, I'm a very outdoorsy person. I really don't care for staying in 5-star hotels. I don't care for eating at expensive restaurants. I do care about hiking and scuba diving and surfing and trying new sports outside. So the really natural thing for me to pursue was adventure travel, just because that is what I like to do.
But was there something, I mean, when you were growing up, that a trip that you went on that went, oh, you know, maybe I'd like to focus on this one day?
Oh, well, I grew up in a very small town in British Columbia. If you walked out of our backyard and kept going straight, you would go about 80 miles before you crossed a paved road.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents growing up did not allow us to watch TV. When we came home, the first thing they said was, go outside. And they just would kick us out of the house to go play in the woods. And that was how I grew up. And in the winter, we skied every single weekend. So my youth and growing up was always spent outside, you know, running around, hiking, climbing, walking through rivers, swimming in lakes, that kind of thing. So it just, that carried through into my adult life. That's really how I like to spend my time.
So when you were living here in Asia, where were some of the places that you visited, and what were some of the most interesting or some of the strangest experiences that you had?
Oh, Asia is a strange place for a Westerner. I got to go to Borneo, which was amazing because the wildlife there is incredible. I was very fortunate to have Malaysia Borneo ask me to go shoot pygmy elephants, which are an incredibly hard animal to find because they roam about 50 miles a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an amazing guide who took me out looking for them there, and we were able to find them in a few days. That was a really incredible experience. In a very different way, in Taiwan once, I had a girlfriend who had a scooter accident in which her foot was hurt very badly. It was swollen up very, very large, about the size of a potato, and she was wearing a cast. We had walked out of a restaurant one evening, and the fellow who owned the liquor store next to the restaurant started calling out to us in Chinese, telling us, come here, come here, come here. So we went in, and my girlfriend didn't speak Chinese at the time, but I did. And he told me that he saw a ghost following her, because in Chinese culture, people believe very strongly in ghosts. And he said that he would help her to get rid of the ghost. And he did not want any money. He really sincerely just wanted to help her. So he sat her down on a stool in his liquor store and started to do all these sort of Tai Chi motions in front of her face. He was just waving his hands around and then started making these strange noises like waka, 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 ooga, ooga. Like, it was very strange and went on for about 30 minutes. And at the end, he told me that he had helped her and he had helped to unblock her chi because her chi was blocked. And that she was not able to get rid of the ghost, but if she came back two more times before the end of ghost month, he could get rid of the ghost.
Right.
So we went home and we were like laughing about it and, you know, just joking around about the noises he made and the funny stuff he did. But when we got home, we were watching TV and she unwrapped her foot to rewrap it. And the swelling had disappeared so quickly that her skin had wrinkled like it was the oversized sock. And whatever he did had taken all of the swelling out of her foot. He never actually physically even touched her once. It was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen. And it astounded us both.
You know, a number of years ago, there was something that happened at a restaurant that was located outside of Shanghai. I was in Shanghai for a bit, and I had some friends that were visiting, Matt, and they were both vegetarian. And as you probably know, in parts of Asia, if you're vegetarian, it's very difficult to find a place to eat, especially if you're a strict vegetarian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we were at this restaurant. And I asked the waitress, I said, okay, I know you have tofu and you have this vegetable thing on the menu. Is there anything else that you have that is vegetarian? And she looked at me with a straight face and said, chicken. And I said, excuse me? And I said, yeah, but chicken is meat. Yeah, but she said chicken doesn't eat meat. And I said, let me, I'll re-ask the question again. And I re-asked her in Chinese. I said, do you have anything that is not meat-based and is not cooked with meat and is not meat? And then she said, pork. And I said, excuse me? And she said, yeah, but pigs and chickens don't eat meat. I said, no, you don't understand. Anyway, I just felt like I was in a comedy. And at that point, I said, you know what? Let's just order the tofu. Yeah. And it'll be a lot easier. Now, there must be some people that ask you, Matt, you know, I wanted to do some adventure traveling. What should I do? Should I prepare or should I just get on a plane and go somewhere?
Well, you know, that's a very personal kind of question to ask. So it's a very hard thing to answer for anyone because really what it comes down to is the kind of experience that a person is going to enjoy. And there are a lot of people who are not comfortable just jumping off into the unknown and, you know, going for it, which is my favorite way to travel. But I'm a very different type of person than the things I enjoy. I really enjoy getting myself into very uncomfortable and awful situations and then trying to get out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's not for everybody. I once rented a motorcycle in Borneo when it was the dry season in Taiwan. And Borneo is only a few hundred kilometers south from Taiwan. So I assumed they had the same rainy season, and I was completely wrong. And I drove into a monsoon on a motorcycle in the middle of nowhere where I had to drive for 12 hours to get to a place. And I enjoy that in a really strange, very weird way. So I don't think that kind of travel is the best for everyone, but I always recommend to people that you should not plan everything you do.
No, but the thing is, you know, Matt,
explore on your own.
But the thing is, Matt, you know, you get stuck in a rainstorm. I mean, myself, I would look at that as being, I would laugh at the situation myself. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, you know?
Well, when you get to something that's that ridiculous, I've never seen rain like that. It was one of those days where the stilt houses?
Right.
The water was up to the floor of the stilt houses on the sides of the road, which was raised. It was very, very extreme. But there is something really comedic about it. When you do that, you can only laugh at it because you have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't just stop. That's impossible. It's not an option. And I enjoy those situations where you make yourself sink or swim, and so that you can see that you will swim and you will eventually get yourself out of it. And I also just enjoy, I never read a guidebook before I go somewhere. I like to just show up and learn for myself the hard way. And that way, the things that you do find are more special because you found them on your own rather than being shown them by somebody else.
Matt Gibson, adventure holiday maker. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Next week, we're going to be back to our regular program. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. Until next time, so long, and take care.